What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Now you listen to me, Adam. I'm a movie man, not a red herring. I've got a job, a secretary, a mother, two ex-wives, and several bartenders that depend upon me. And I don't intend to disappoint them all by getting myself slightly killed.
Then your name isn't really Kaplan.
Can't say it is, because it ain't.
Well, you'll have to do for a discussion of The Bourne Legacy and this week's Film Spotting Top 5, Cinema Spies.
That gun looks more fitting for a woman.
Do you know much about guns, Mr. Bond?
No, I know a little about women.
We'll also discuss the fifth film in our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, Fireworks Wednesday. All that and more ahead on Film Spotting. This podcast is brought to you by the new Squarespace. Squarespace introduces a new content management system, making it faster and easier to create a high-quality website or blog, plus mobile responsive designs with automatic device scaling and more than 50 other new features.
For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM8. Again, that's squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM8. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. John Updike said, "From infancy on, we are all spies. The shame is not this, but that the secrets to be discovered are so paltry and few." We'll offer up our top five cinema spies whose secrets are laudable and many later in the show.
But first, it's called The Bourne Legacy, but Jason Bourne is nowhere to be found. No big deal, or will Adam and I be filing a complaint for false advertising?
Jason Bourne was the tip of the iceberg.
It's Aaron Cross. We have never seen evaluations like this. He's Treadstone without the inconsistency.
I've never met anybody in the program.
So how many of us are there?
You asked too many questions.
A few days ago on Twitter, I got into a super important debate with some friends of the show about what the hell to label The Bourne Legacy. My position was that the now commonplace term reboot applies because director and co-screenwriter Tony Gilroy isn't just making the next movie in the series that started with 2002's The Bourne Identity. He's restarting the franchise with a new lead, Jeremy Renner's Aaron Cross, and a new cold-blooded CIA bigwig, Edward Norton. But the events of Identity, 2004's Bourne Supremacy, and 2007's Bourne Ultimatum weren't wiped away by the new movie, so it's really just a sequel, they argued. And fairly convincingly, too, until someone noted that The Bourne Legacy actually unfolds concurrently with the previous film. For those of you keeping score at home, then, that means Jason Bourne is running around Manhattan seeking closure to his story at the same time Aaron Cross is running around the globe trying to avoid being assassinated by the agency that trained him while protecting a scientist played by Rachel Weisz from the same fate. So if it's not a sequel or a prequel and not a reboot, what is it? A sidequel? A spinoff? And does anyone care? No, of course no one cares, but semantics aside, I was surprised, Josh, at just how closely linked The Bourne Legacy was to its predecessors. They weren't kidding around with the title. If you haven't brushed up on your Operation Blackbriar recently, Legacy might lose you a bit. Did placing this film so firmly in the Bourne context ultimately work in its favor for you, or would you have preferred to watch Cross blossom outside of Bourne shadow? More importantly, will you collaborate with me on my screenplay for The Bourne Context, where we follow Aaron Cross as he struggles to earn his PhD in comparative literature?
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
Great.
Count me in for the screenplay. First of all, every debate on Twitter is super important.
It's
don't,
the place
you
for
know
super
that,
important
Adam?
Debates.
I mean, come on.
I know.
You don't need to contextualize that. I really liked that Bourne was out there running around. I thought that was kind of a cool touch. He's a little bit of a ghost here. And I didn't really try to put the chronology together. And until you said that, I was thinking it was more of a after-the-fact story. But you're right. Maybe the last 20 minutes of the last Bourne film are the first 20 minutes here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of a nice touch. I did think about Bourne a couple times while this movie was going on. Sometimes it's purposefully because they'll show you in a cabin very early on, a training cabin where he scratched his name in the wood. And so that brings it to mind. But I also liked how what that did is allowed him to linger, and it expanded this universe in an interesting way so that we're seeing this whole story from another angle. I like that a lot. I like this film quite a bit, actually.
Well, we can certainly get into the specifics of what works with this film, because several things do work. Big picture, I think the key question is whether Tony Gilroy and whether his new hero, Jeremy Renner, did enough for me to care about the second Aaron Cross film that surely is coming. This is going to be, it seems, the start to another franchise. And they did. Whether it's Doug Liman with the first movie or Greengrass with the last two or Gilroy here, whether it's Matt Damon or Jeremy Renner, something about this Bourne universe clearly does appeal to me. That said, I certainly wouldn't suggest that they needed to completely extricate Aaron Cross from Jason Bourne, but I do wish that the brothers Gilroy, Tony and his brother Dan, who co-wrote the screenplay, had found a way to set up this story and the stakes of the story without having to be so tied to what happened in the Bourne ultimatum. Just in terms of storytelling, don't get me wrong, flashbacks can be used really effectively in movies. In movies that alternate between the present and the past can be really effective. But especially in the first 20 to 30 minutes of this film, I just felt like we were alternating between past events that are mostly redundant to anybody who saw the last film and present events that just really aren't that compelling. I'm thinking of the scenes with Aaron Cross on this seeming training mission where he's walking over some mountains. It's just not that fascinating. And the whole time we're jumping around in the chronology, we're jumping around in time, we're jumping around in space as well from country to country as the screenwriters try to get all the pieces in place, get all that exposition out of the way. I just couldn't wait for this plot to actually get moving so the story, this Aaron Cross story, could emerge and I could grab onto something I cared about. And unfortunately, once it does get moving, the central objective, what Aaron Cross is primarily after, his main motivation, I thought was pretty weak on the whole.
I thought it was very suspenseful, the opening, how they were bringing those things together in a gradual way. So you see Aaron Cross, you start to learn about his abilities. I mean, one thing they've got to do here is make you believe that this guy is as good of an agent, I don't know if that's what you'd call him, but whatever he is as good as Bourne. And so that's what that opening is of him in the training montage, and I think that worked. At the same time, they have these backroom scenes of the conspiring going on against him, and I could see how those two things were coming together, and waiting for that worked for me. Now, were there a lot of flashbacks in those opening scenes to the other films? I mean, there weren't direct scenes
there
from
these actually
films,
Patty
were there?
Considine. There was some footage that clearly they either took just right from Ultimatum or maybe some things that were left on the
assassination
cutting room
floor. Right, yeah, okay,
including
that's true.
That scene, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more of
the scenes with David Strathern setting up the shop that they're in where they're monitoring all the events of Ultimatum. Yeah. Some of that footage is used.
I guess maybe it's because I didn't revisit the other three films before this. Maybe I just appreciated that, and I liked getting a little bit of that context. If they're going to weave these two stories together, and again, I was glad they did. I found that interesting and unique. They're going to have some of that context in place. So that didn't bother me at all. As far as the larger objective, I don't really care. I mean, these spy movies, the whole plot is a MacGuffin. It doesn't really matter what he's after or what his goal is. The point is someone's trying to kill him. How is he going to get away? That's all that really has to be put into place. So you're right. What he is after isn't some huge world-changing goal, but it is enough to get him in motion. And I also thought it was interesting because it was such a personal goal that it did add another dimension. I don't know how much we want to give away, but we do learn something about his character in that he wants the medication.
I think we can say that. The movie doesn't hide this at all.
It doesn't hide it, no. So he wants the medication that he's on.
The chems.
As
we hear 100 times.
Yeah, well, they use chems a lot. He has a particular reason, though, which I found really interesting. It's not that it makes him super strong, super fast, but we find out that he barely made it into the army. In fact, his recruiter had to fake his IQ score because he wouldn't have made it in. So for him, getting on these chems, which raise your intellectual level as well, is a way for him to have a whole different life. I found that pretty resonant, actually, and made for some good back and forth with him and Vise in that he needs these chems, he needs her to get them, and she needs him to stay alive. So a lot of times in these movies, you have the female character tagging along, and often you'll say, why doesn't he just get rid of her? I thought this movie found a compelling reason for them to need and help each other.
You're listening to Film Spotting, Adam Kempinar with Josh Larson discussing the new film, The Bourne Legacy. It's really interesting, though, that that worked for you in terms of his motivations, and we are going to have to dance around this a little bit because we're getting into some spoiler territory, and I don't want to go there, but that incentive, what he's after, his objective to get these chems because it's what makes him a super spy. I'm sorry, that's just not an interesting hook to hang a film around, even a spy movie, even an action movie. I need something a little bit more compelling than that. I need some stakes, Josh. And we finally get them later. I'll just say that there's a little reveal. There's a little throwaway moment where Aaron Cross finally says something about why he needs these chems. That's a more compelling reason for all of this action to take place than simply it makes him smarter and a better jumper. But it takes us to get halfway through the movie at least, and to just experience it with this throwaway moment to actually understand what the stakes are. I felt like that was unfortunate. I do give them credit. I'm with you that I recognize how hard of a task it is to introduce us to a new world, to create a newborn universe, while at the same time having it locked within this older one. There is going to be some exposition. There's going to be some context that's created. I just wish they'd found a way to make it a little less clunky while also giving us that compelling reason to drive all of the action forward. I just didn't really feel like that hook was here.
Well, I want to talk about the action, too, because I thought that was something that worried me a little bit with Gilroy having done Michael Clayton and Duplicity, not really done these large-scale action scenes. And I thought he pulled them off here. I thought they really worked. It's the kind of action movie which walks right up to the edge of absurdity, but somehow has enough realism in it to make you not laugh at it, but kind of laugh in appreciation that they're really going to go for this. There's an early scene in the training sequence, a little bit after it, I guess, where he encounters a wolf. And this scene is either going to push you out of the movie or you're going to buy in. And I'm just curious how you felt about the action in general and the wolf scene in particular.
Well, I did like the wolf scene. I thought that worked. There was a nice little surprise there in terms of what he was doing, what his goal was, and I really like where that scene went. So that worked for me. There is a fantastic camera trick moment later in one of the big action scenes at the end of the film where we actually follow Renner as he runs up a building into a room, yeah, across a roof. The camera follows him the whole way. That's a really nice trick. On the whole, nothing about the visual style of this film really bothered me. I think it works for the most part. Gilroy seems to me to be in a middle ground where Doug Liman was even more restrained than you would expect from any kind of action film, more restrained than this film in terms of it being a little bit more of a character drama, the shots being generally longer, fewer close-ups. And then you've got the exact opposite of that, of course, with the last two films, Paul Greengrass, that hyperkinetic editing style and the close-ups and the handheld. And then you've got Gilroy sort of straddling a little bit more of a middle ground. There's a little bit more of a conventional action movie setup with the way this film works.
Yeah, and I think what he brings to it in terms of the conversations is a new wrinkle and improves upon those. The dialogue, how it goes back and forth, which has always been a strength of his. I really appreciated that in this movie. Some of the conversations have that sense of danger, the same sense of danger that the action scenes have. Edward Norton is really good in this, I thought. He's pulling the strings behind the scenes. And there are times when he's going to be the guy laying down the hammer, but I also like the little moments where you could tell he's been caught off guard too.
Right.
And that shows you what Cross is up to and how good he
There's
is.
There's actually one moment in particular where I wish we had a visual aid here so we could impart this moment where someone says something that's just totally unbelievable and they cut to Ed Norton and the look on his face is priceless, as if how could that possibly be? He's just a little bit in shock, but he's really restrained. It's great.
Yeah, I like that vulnerability he brings, because usually in that part, you know, you have no flaws. You're the villain. And Edward Norton brings a good twist to that. And again, I think the conversations between Renner and Vise really work well here.
I do too.
She's
I really like
playing,
her here.
Yeah, I think it's a really good role, in the type of role that often is just an afterthought for action films. I think that she brings a lot of intelligence to the part while still being, you know, they allow her to be the feminine character who's not going to match him in terms of action. We're not going back to Haywire here. Yet she still brings a lot to the narrative. And again, like I said, she has elements that are as necessary for him as he is for her.
Agreed. I really like Rachel Weisz in this film. I like her resolve. I like the intellect that comes through, her mental toughness that comes through, but she still is fragile enough, and certainly physically as well. And she's got really good chemistry with Renner. This film underplays any potential love story, I would say, even more than The Bourne Identity did with Franka Potenta and Matt Damon. In that movie, you saw that was going to be leading somewhere. Here, you can start to fill in those blanks if you want, but I don't think the movie does anything blatant to draw attention to it. I think it's just because they're good together, and it makes sense for them on some level to be together. So I like their chemistry in this movie. It's interesting that you bring up Ed Norton, though, because I guess while I was thinking about some of the larger questions the movie is or isn't dealing with and talking about the stakes a little bit, there's a really interesting scene where we get a flashback with Ed Norton talking to Jeremy Renner that kind of sets up this entire Bourne universe.
I need you to stop what you're doing and turn around. That's an order. We got screwed on the intel, okay? Nobody knew those people were in there. It would be perfectly normal for a person to have doubts about the morality of what we just asked you to do.
Is that a question, sir?
No, it's not. Tune into what I'm trying to say to you. Do you know what a sin eater is? Well, that's what we are. We are the sin eaters. It means that we take the moral excrement that we find in this equation and we bury it down deep inside of us so that the rest of our cause can stay pure. That is the job. We are morally indefensible and absolutely necessary. You understand?
So as I said, I think those are really key phrases in the Bourne world, this notion of doing morally indefensible acts, but them being necessary. They're serving a higher cause. He says that we have to do this. We have to eat the sin so the rest of our cause can remain pure. I think my problem with this film on some level was that I was lacking that bigger picture cause here. And I don't necessarily even mean something philosophical or patriotic, just something to invest in beyond, as we were talking about, I need to get my medicine. I think there was just not enough care in setting up everything about this world. That's a great scene, but I wish that it had done a little bit more with it. But one of the things I found interesting, I wonder if you noted this as well, Josh, thinking about some of the movies we've seen this summer, some of the bigger tentpole films, this is now the third film that I'm aware of that deals with an interesting ethical conundrum dealing with science. It goes back to Spider-Man. It comes up again in The Dark Knight Rises. It's certainly here in The Bourne Legacy, which is this question of how you employ scientific discoveries and breakthroughs that can be applied for less than humanistic purposes. So you're a scientist, you've got this idea, it's something you can follow through on and you think you can bring to fruition. Do you create it or do you not create it? Do you actually hold back because, yes, something good might come from it, but also it could be applied for nefarious purposes? That's a really interesting question that I wonder if there's something in the water these days that makes this a relevant question that films are dealing with.
I think it's tied to things like military drones as well, which Bourne Legacy touches on directly. Yeah, it sounds like there are a lot of intriguing questions to the movie that you are asking for that are actually there. You might like this more
than you actually realize. No, that's one of the things I responded to as a positive, for sure.
I think that that conversation we played is almost too on the nose for this film. I don't know that I needed it. I liked it because here are Renner and Norton kind of facing off, and you get your villain and hero in a scene together in a movie that otherwise has them thousands of miles apart. So I like that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But thematically, it's a little bit on the nose because these things are always percolating throughout the movie. In fact, throughout the series, what this series has been about is waking up, and Bourne is waking up to not only who he is but what he's done or what he's been programmed to do. And Renner has a similar experience here, but it's not just Renner, it's also Weiss's character, as you mentioned, with the science. She has a line at one point where they're kind of sharing their sins. I was just there for the science
and I'm doing my job. I was
doing
my
job.
Yeah,
exactly. So they're both in the same position a little bit, and I think when those lines are tossed off in a natural conversation like that between Renner and Weiss, it works out a lot better than when it's that showdown between Renner and
Norton.
Yeah,
there's no doubt that occasionally films will take almost a timeout to give you that big theme and serve it to you on a platter. It does here, and yet I thought it worked in the context because it's well written. I thought the lines were good. I thought they were well delivered. And by making it a flashback where it justifies something we just saw happen, I thought it was okay even if it was totally on the nose. I also was struck by, and I guess I'll say this as a positive, I thought it was interesting watching some of the homages or some of the nods to the Bourne Identity. This film opens with a character in water, just as the Bourne Identity does.
I like that opening image.
Ultimatum ends. That's a great opening image that links us to this larger universe. I also really like the fact that we get that moment between Rachel Weisz and Jeremy Renner in a hotel. They've finally stopped, just like Matt Damon and Franca Potenza did in the first film, the first time they stop at a Paris hotel. And we get a moment where Rachel Weisz is standing in front of a mirror and Jeremy Renner comes up behind her and they have a conversation. I thought I was watching The Bourne Identity. I think very clearly Gilroy was going for a visual nod to that first film.
Yeah, certainly. And that's a common scene in a lot of spy on the run or guy on the run films, too. You got to take that breather, and it often is as a fugitive in a hotel room. And I thought this one, despite it being a familiar setup, played really nicely, again, because of the two. We've probably actually talked about Weisz more than Renner here.
Well, let's get to him.
He really did the job for me. I mean, I still appreciated Damon better. I think he brought some different things to it that Renner doesn't have, but they're very similar physically, and this is a very physical role. They're kind of stocky, and they have this sort of schoolyard fight sensibility to them. But I think Renner has a little bit more of a lightness to him, even in the opening sequence where he comes upon this cabin after training and runs into another agent.
Oscar Isaac.
Yeah.
Great actor.
Oscar Isaac. I was glad to see that. Wish he had stuck around a little bit longer, but that often happens to Oscar Isaac for some reason.
Right.
So he has this casual relationship, and Oscar Isaac's character wants nothing to do with it. He's all serious about this. And I liked that aspect of the role. Now, Cross gets more serious as the stakes are raised and things get more intense along the way. But it was just a little difference that he added to the part.
I agree. I think the key thing that stands out is Jeremy Renner has more of a sense of humor, or Aaron Cross has more of a sense of humor than Jason Bourne, I should say. And so that's a nice touch. There are moments where Jason Bourne almost feels too robotic, and I think that Jeremy Renner brings Aaron Cross to life in a way that's different, and I was glad to see that. That said, this is unfair because I really can't articulate it other than to say that I thought I would have liked Jeremy Renner more than I did in this film. Again, I'm not entirely sure why. Something about his age seemed to really stand out to me. I don't know about you, but he seems so much older than Matt Damon did as
really?
Jason Bourne to me. I think right from the early scenes, it might have been the beard, but even physically, the way he's built, his face, the lines in his face, I believe Jeremy Renner is about 38 years old, and you can see that, I felt like, in this character. Now, why is that a bad thing for Aaron Cross? I don't have an answer for that. I don't know why it stuck out to me, but it did. So something about Jeremy Renner felt a little bit off to me this entire film, but he's an actor I really appreciate. And like I said, I look forward to seeing him in future Aaron Cross films.
Yeah, it was interesting that you brought that up at the start, whether or not this movie would make you want to see another one. I don't know if that's a fair gauge for a film. I mean, a film, even if it's part of a larger franchise and is some sort of reboot that they hope will lead to other sequels, I don't care if it makes me want to see more sequels. I just care that this one works. And I do feel, in seeing some early responses to the Bourne legacy, there are some people who just can't shake the other Bourne films and are taking it out on this one for having a different director and for having a different star.
Mm-hmm.
When if this movie existed in a vacuum, it would be received, I believe, as well as the original Bourne films, because it does a lot of the same things just as well in terms of its stripped down action.
I think the problem is it does a lot of the same things that we've already seen and feels redundant and doesn't do them as well as Doug Liman did them or Paul Greengrass did them.
Well, I think it does it just as well. It's just that when it comes as number four, you are a little tired of it. So then do we hold that completely against the film?
Well, Tony Gilroy, who co-wrote the other film, certainly knows what he's dealing with here. So I think it's fair to expect him to contend with that.
And to do something extraordinarily different
and
better.
Yeah, I think
that's
a reasonable expectation, or at least to take it in a different direction, which he doesn't do here. But let me rephrase. I'm not really interested in where this is going to go as a franchise. I think what I was saying in terms of whether or not I'm interested in seeing a second film is just an extension of a question I ask myself a lot of times when I see any movie, which is, when it's over, am I still thinking about those characters? Am I interested in what happened to those characters? Do I want to project where they may go in the future? That's really all I'm saying. I think I want to know where Aaron Cross is going to go next. I think whatever adventures are in store for him, that's something I want to see.
Okay, that's an interesting scale, because I could very easily live without another Bourne film. But that doesn't take away from my...
So different reactions to the film overall a little bit, but we come out differently on whether or not we want more
Apparently.
Bourne movies. Well, unfortunately, because it would take us too much into spoiler territory, and we've probably said enough about the Bourne legacy, we can't get into the villain spy that comes up at the end of the film and whether or not that all plays out in a satisfactory way. We'll have to maybe save that for some bonus content in the future. The Bourne legacy is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. You can also find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Adam and I will adopt top secret aliases to perform Massacre Theater next, then come in from the cold to discuss the latest film in our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, Fireworks Wednesday.
With the passing last week of Oscar-winning composer Marvin Hamlisch, we thought we'd feature his work this week on the show. And in a show devoted to Jason Bourne and our favorite cinema spies, how can we not play this very memorable song from the James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me? Stay with us.
Nobody does it better. Makes me feel sad for the rest.
Very excited to have Squarespace back on board as a sponsor of Film Spotting. But it's not just Squarespace. It's the new Squarespace. They've officially launched. There's no credit card required to try it out. You just have to go to squarespace.com/film and start your trial. Just be sure to use offer code FILM8 when you purchase for a 10% discount.
Squarespace is really great for aspiring filmmakers, and we do have listeners who are filmmakers, also directors, editors, cinematographers, graphic designers too. They can get a lot out of Squarespace. There's a completely new design. The templates showcase your films, your videos, reviews in a gallery. They can do collages or even slideshows. It's really easy to use. The drag and drop works like an OS. The structure has perfectly clean code, and everything's integrated. Your design, your domains, hosting, and support.
The responsive design really is a neat feature. Basically, your entire site will restructure automatically to fit on every device and maintain the content and beauty of the site's design. You can also import and integrate social media, bring your content from your current blog, or link to other social media accounts. Custom domains are available when you sign up for a year of Squarespace. You get a free custom domain name, and the support is really a key feature. We've heard from listeners over the years who use Squarespace. They love the fact that you have 24/7 customer support that responds in minutes. They also have live online workshops to walk you step by step through everything you need to build an amazing site.
The standard plan is $10 a month, and for $20 a month, you can get the unlimited plan. Also, if you sign up for a year, you automatically get 20% off, and if you sign up for 2 years, you get 25% off. Go to squarespace.com/film. Don't forget to use the offer code FILM8 to get an additional 10% off during checkout.
Portrait. Do you see a portrait?
No.
If I could just find the key, the beginning, and put it together.
So explain it away. There is a way to explain it, you see. If I'm mad, that would explain it, wouldn't it?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was Jimmy Stewart with Kim Novak from the great Alfred Hitchcock film Vertigo, the movie that was recently crowned, Josh, the greatest film of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics and Directors poll. I believe it was the critics who named it.
Yeah, the new greatest movie of
all
time.
That's right. It did usurp Citizen Kane from its number one spot, which I think it had been in there since 1952. And they do this poll every 10 years. Obviously, 2012, the new iteration of the Sight and Sound list came out. We're going to get to a poll question and also preview next week's show, where we'll get into the Sight and Sound list a little more in depth. But now it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a famous screenplay and you get a chance at winning a prize. On our last show, Josh and I massacred this scene.
I'm going to be glad to do the show on Broadway, and there'll probably be other offers, keeping our fingers crossed. But I don't know if the theater and the stage is for me. I mean, for one thing, there's an awful lot of memorizing of lines. And I think you know what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's always been
the ultimate goal, Hollywood. Even when I was a kid doing my impressions, here's looking at you, babe, and you don't care about anyone but yourself. Who is it? Henry Fonda. I always have to tell her who I'm doing. She always laughs, but now who is that? But I think back there's always the germ in my mind that's where I'd end up on the silver screen. Mm-hmm. And you got the face for it, too, darling.
You know, I want to try that less is more kind of acting, where you just, when you're talking to someone, you close your eyes, and then you look at them when you're not talking to the person. I mean, you open your eyes when you're looking away, but then when you talk to the person, you go like that. And you open your eyes, and then you look back at the person, but you never open your eyes when you're talking to them.
That's Fred Willard. Yes, the Fred Willard from the news these days. And Catherine O'Hara as Ron and Sheila Albertson from 1996's Waiting for Guffman, directed by Christopher Guest, written by Christopher Guest and Eugene Levy.
We did discuss William Friedkin's adaptation of Tracy Let's Play Killer Joe last show, so Nicole Bernas-Ney in Queens, New York had the obvious tie-in. Honestly, and this may have more to do with my half-dozen viewings of the Guest classic and drama major than anything else, but I knew what film you were massacring before you even said action. The tie-in, of course, is that Guffman is a film about terrible, if enthusiastic, community theater, and Killer Joe was based on a work of theater. So glad that Guest, as well as Fred Willard and Catherine O'Hara, got some massacre theater love. I'll stop gushing now and grab a sandwich out of my remains of the day lunchbox and go play with my Dinner with Andre action figure.
You know Nicole is a big fan of Waiting for Guffman, which you can just drop those lines casually into the email. Thank you, Nicole, for that. There was a lot of love for Guffman. A few people thought it might have been Best in Show instead.
Yeah.
I can see that. There was something about our performances. I think we were just so good capturing the improvisational genius of Catherine O'Hara and Fred Willard that they knew it had to be a Christopher Guest film. Few people, like I said, got the wrong one, but there were a lot of entries correctly identifying Waiting for Guffman. Josh, reach into the film spotting hat and pick out the winner.
The winner's Andrew Kasten from Richardson, Texas.
Congratulations, Andrew. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prizes. Of course, not only is Andrew going to get his free trial to Fandor.com, but he's also going to get his choice of one of three new Sony Pictures home entertainment DVDs, the psychological thriller Meeting Evil with Samuel L. Jackson and Luke Wilson, or the Hatfields and McCoys miniseries from the History Channel with Kevin Costner and Bill Paxton, or we do have another copy of Lockout, a.k.a. Space Jail, the sci-fi space thriller starring Guy Pearce.
I think I'm going to recommend Hatfields and McCoys
really?
For Andrew. I've not seen any of these films. I don't know Andrew at all, but that's my pick.
That's
for him.
Your recommendation. Andrew, send us an email. Let us know which one you want.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York. Terrific.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent foreign and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
All right, I don't think we're going to need to give any hints or any connections to this week's show. It's going to be pretty obvious as we get into the dialogue. I'm going to be pretty curious to see how many entries we get.
I think this is going to be a tough one.
I think it's going to be tough. The scene is pretty easily identifiable to the film if you know it, but I don't know that this film is a really well-known film. It's certainly not as well-known as Waiting for Guffman, I would say. So it'll be interesting to see how many results we get. Josh, I'm going to start it off, so you're going to give me the action.
All right, here we go. And action.
That decision is not yours to make. What we will do is catch this guy ourselves before anyone knows what happened. After we've got him, we'll handle the rest of it.
You mean the gentleman in the next room?
The man we're after is a spy and a murderer. Would anyone deny that justice had been done?
Yeah, I would.
Well, we shall have that discussion at the appropriate time. But for now, I expect you to follow direct orders, and I expect you to demonstrate the personal loyalty to which both the secretary and I have every right.
You expect a lot.
I depend on you. We're friends.
Oh, God.
And if it were your intention to do anything to bring down the secretary, then I'd have no choice but to make sure that you didn't get away with it.
Thank you for the warning.
I'm quite certain it's unnecessary. When you calm down, you'll see we're following the only possible course.
And scene.
That was my best pseudo Hal from 2001 voice. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, August 21st.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
David Webb.
That's your real name. You were born 4-15-71 in Nixon, Missouri. Why don't you come in and we'll talk about it?
Get some rest, man. You look tired.
That's 2007's The Bourne Ultimatum, a movie that came up a lot in our discussion in the previous segment of the new film, The Bourne Legacy, and it transitions us into our poll results on our last show. A couple weeks ago, we did have a little bit of a respite from Film Spotting, had a week off last week. We asked you to rate your excitement for The Bourne Legacy, for what seems to be a new Bourne franchise. Here were your options. The Bourne identity has been compromised. The program should have been shut down. I'm somewhat skeptical, but Gilroy and Renner are perfect new recruits. Or Bourne is my Bond. Keep them coming. Josh, how did it come out?
Keep 'Em Coming was in last place with 20%. In the middle, The Bourne Identity has been compromised. 32% of voters thought they should have just shut this thing down. But winning, I'm somewhat skeptical, but Gilroy Renner are perfect new recruits with 48%.
Now, if I recall correctly, Josh, I actually convinced you to come over to my side, and you voted with me that Bourne is my new Bond. You wanted them to keep coming, and yet, after liking The Bourne Legacy more than I did, you don't really care to see a second one.
I don't need any more. I'm changing my vote again.
Wow. I cannot keep up with your many moods. Let's get to this week's poll question. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. It brings us back to Vertigo. And doesn't that open up a nice opportunity for me to do my Jimmy Stewart?
Please.
Doesn't the world need to hear my Jimmy Stewart? No. I'm not going to.
Tease us.
I'm going to tease you. I'm not going to damage anyone further by bringing out my Jimmy Stewart, maybe on next week's show. But with the Sight and Sound Greatest Films poll finally coming out, the 2012 version, hundreds of critics, hundreds of directors vote. We see the top 10. They also put out the top 100 based on all of the voting. Vertigo was crowned the new greatest film of all time. It did supplant Citizen Kane, and that gave us an obvious poll question for this week. It's a Sight and Sound Greatest Films poll death match. Your choices are
Citizen Kane or Vertigo.
Which way do you come out? Do you think the voters made the right choice, or do you think it's ridiculous that Vertigo would overtake Citizen Kane? You can vote now at filmspotting.net. We'll share the results next week, appropriately on our show that we're going to devote to our entries. If we'd been asked for votes, been asked for our top 10 greatest films of all time, I can't believe we're going to do this, Josh, but we're going to enlist the help of Michael Phillips for his monthly appearance, the great film critic from the Chicago Tribune, regular contributor here on Film Spotting. He's going to join us, and you're going to hear all three of us attempt to come to terms with the 10 movies that we actually believe are the greatest films of all time.
Well, and this might be a little bit of a hint for my list, but this isn't actually much of a death match for me.
Really?
It's clearly Citizen Kane, just because Vertigo, I would probably place maybe three other Hitchcock films ahead of Vertigo.
Okay, well, I would put Vertigo, and I recently posted my top five Hitchcock on our Twitter account at FilmSpotting in honor of Hitchcock's birthday. This became a little bit of a meme the other day, and Vertigo for me was number one, but I'm with you that I wouldn't put it ahead of Citizen Kane.
Okay,
I'm sorry to be so stodgy and conventional there with my choice, but I'm putting Citizen Kane.
You don't like change, do you?
No, I'm putting it ahead of Vertigo. I think Citizen Kane's going to win, but nevertheless, we have a younger audience. I'm guessing a lot of people came to Vertigo maybe before they came to Citizen Kane. Maybe they have a soft spot for it. So then again, Citizen Kane is a movie that a lot of film students absolutely have to watch. Not that Vertigo isn't. So we'll see how it comes out. I'm really curious. You can vote now, as we said, at filmspotting.net. A couple other quick plugs we did want to mention. Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. This is our spinoff podcast. Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore. The 14th episode of Film Spotting SVU was just posted this week. They discussed their Listener's Choice review. It was Margaret, the Kenneth Lonergan film that, of course, got a lot of buzz as a movie that was being overlooked at awards time, largely because no one was getting a chance to see it. And there was this Team Margaret movement. It's out now on demand. Matt and Allison talk about that on this week's show and also get into a lot of other great recommendations that are available via streaming of teen movies similar or not so similar in some cases to the movie Margaret. So if you're not already subscribed to Film Spotting SVU, we highly encourage you to do so. You can get it now in iTunes or just grab the RSS feed at filmspotting.net. Also on our website, we're excited to announce another contest courtesy of Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Two new DVDs to give away. We're going to pick two separate winners of these DVDs. We've got a copy of The Raid Redemption, which is a movie Matt and Allison recently talked about on SVU, and season 3 of the show Community. All you got to do, Josh, email feedback at filmspotting.net. Separate emails, please. Tell us what your favorite movie that takes place in a school is. Something similar
got
to Community.
It.
And if you want the Raid Redemption DVD, give us your favorite movie fight scene. Neither email has to be very long, but just give us your quick pick, a quick explanation for why that's your favorite fight scene or your favorite movie that takes place in a school. We'll pick two winners and announce them on next week's show.
We're not offering any Space Jail in this contest?
That's, no, not this week. Space Jail is just for Massacre Theater, Josh.
Okay, got it.
Okay.
We're up to the fifth film in our marathon on contemporary Iranian cinema. And as we get back to this, Adam, it's hard not to think of the two recent earthquakes that claimed hundreds of lives in northwest Iran. Certainly our thoughts go out to those who were affected by that tragedy. I think it's fair to say we've gotten a better sense of Iran and its culture through mm-hmm. this marathon, which makes a story like this feel all the more urgent. These marathons are chances for us to immerse ourselves in the work of notable directors or particular genres or specific time periods of movie history. And all summer long, we've been exploring Iranian cinema of the past 20 years. In the last 10 years, writer-director Asghar Farhadi has proven himself to be a careful observer of knotty human relationships. He won a foreign language film Oscar this year for A Separation, a portrayal of a couple on the eve of divorce, and Fireworks Wednesday from 2006 centers on a couple who may very well be headed in that same direction. The wife in the film suspects that her husband is having an affair. Meanwhile, he's becoming exasperated, even violent, over her constant spying and accusations. We see all of this through the eyes of a young house cleaner, played by Tarana Eladusti, who has been hired for the day and is soon to be married herself. The movie draws a stark contrast between the youthful optimism of the maid, who we first see flirting with her attentive fiancé, and the exhaustion and bitterness of the older married couple. Overall, the movie left me feeling fairly depressed, even in a way that I wasn't after A Separation, which is arguably more of a downer. So what was your impression, Adam? Did Fireworks Wednesday leave you feeling hopeful about the power of young love, or did you come away sensing that this maid's marriage is doomed as well?
That's a really great question, because the ending certainly does leave a lot open for interpretation. I think maybe it's more depressing simply because even though the truth that comes out at the end of A Separation really does just complicate things further, at least it provides some clarity. And I think with Fireworks Wednesday, the film overall is less interested in anything legal and the individual actions of the characters, so there's just generally more ambiguity, although there is also a little twist reveal that's interesting that Farhadi has in this film that reminded me of A Separation. I guess I'll throw it back to you a little bit, though, Josh. If it is more depressing, is that necessarily a bad thing? Does that bring the film down in your estimation?
No, I don't hold it against it at all. It's just this feeling of, and I think you hit on it at the end, there's still some sort of duplicity or deceit going on. A Separation by no means has closure.
Right.
But they're maybe closer to closure. Does that make sense? And here, not only has the central relationship between the husband and wife not moved in any significant way.
Okay, maybe we disagree on that.
Well, that would be interesting to hear. But also in contrast, when you put that in contrast with the younger maid, it just left me with that feeling of this is what she's likely headed for, a life like this.
Well, I think that is a reasonable interpretation. But if I had to answer your question, and I do, because, of course, you're holding my feet to the fire, I ultimately feel like it is hopeful, because I think the characters we see at the end of the film, including the husband, are hopeful. And there's a moment where you think that the fiancé of the maid is going to judge her, that she could be in trouble, that in fact, not only are they maybe on the road that the older couple is, they're going to start down that road right this very moment. And instead of reproaching her, he actually compliments her. And it's a very sweet moment. And in light of that really sweet moment and that exchange, both verbally and non-verbally between them, that gave me hope.
Yeah, that's true. I love that touch. I think it does point to the complicated nature and why Farhadi is so good at getting at this knottiness of human relationships, because he can allow for that sweetness too. I guess that's not what I was left with, because in the earlier portions of the film, we get tiny glimpses of how this older couple was like that younger couple at
probably
one time. Many times you'll notice their wedding photo is in the background of a shot in their apartment. And it happens so often that you know it's purposeful. And they look pretty much exactly like the younger couple.
Right.
And it's just echoes of that that make it hard for me to latch onto the hopefulness of the young couple at the end. But you're right. I think this makes it a better film in a lot of ways, in that it is that complicated. I'm by no means holding it against the film that it left me feeling like these two may not be achieving the happiness that they think they're going to get in life.
Well, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think obviously the fact that the movie is called Fireworks Wednesday and it revolves around that experience of the Persian New Year. They're celebrating the new year. It's a sense of a new beginning, of rebirth. And I think what we see here is this new couple, of course, about to get married, about to start on their journey. And the older couple, their marriage is clearly disintegrating, but I think you could also make the case that maybe it's actually starting over, and maybe it is starting over stronger. We probably can't cover this without spoiling too much of the film for people who haven't seen it yet, but I felt like by the end of this movie, because of an encounter he has with another character previously in the film, about 30 minutes before, it suggests to us that maybe this husband and this wife, whether it was his initial plan or not, may actually be getting back on some kind of fair ground, that they may be coming to terms with their relationship. Maybe I'm just being too optimistic.
I think,
Josh,
you're being way too optimistic. I was at that point earlier in the film, and that's why my heart cracked a little bit, because I suspected we weren't really getting his whole story, but the optimistic part of me wanted that to be true. And when it was confirmed that no, this is not exactly what's going on, and it kind of put the husband and wife's relationship way back to the beginning,
mm-hmm.
that's when my heart cracked a little bit, because you're like, oh no, they're really not going to get to that point. And I'll even counter your reference to Fireworks Wednesday. Maybe this is where I'm the pessimist and you're the optimist. I saw the use of that in a very negative way, because the movie starts in the morning, and already, as apparently is part of tradition, fireworks are going off all day long until the evening, when they really explode and there are bonfires in the streets and so forth. What that did for me, I wasn't thinking about New Year's, new beginnings. Throughout the film, I was jumping, literally, because you constantly hear fireworks going
off. I think it works on both those levels,
and
yeah.
And it's making you feel unsettled, because
right.
this entire narrative is unsettled. So sure, the themes of rebirth can be seen there in the new year, but for me, it just kept me unsettled.
It's messy. There's no doubt about the fact that the ending of this film, the film overall, is messy, and maybe it is just kind of a litmus test on how you interpret it, whether you choose to see it optimistically or pessimistically. Something about where the husband character is at the end of the film, something even about the last time we see the wife and the expression on her face. I'm not exactly sure why, but I just got the sense that, you know what, even if their marriage is over, maybe they're going to be better off for it. Somehow that still could be potentially a positive thing. And the fact is, even if you see the younger couple as maybe heading down this path and you think that that's the point that Farhadi is making, I choose to see it instead that he's saying, look, despite what she just went through today, seeing this marriage disintegrate before her eyes as she's cleaning this house and all the horrible positions she was put in, it isn't enough to break her spirit. It's not enough for her to not be hopeful and take a chance. And that ultimately is a good thing.
Yeah, and I like the image they use to convey that, which is where she's sitting at the park while the fireworks are going off at the end of the night. She's still waiting for a ride home from the husband. He's at the park with the son enjoying the fireworks. She's just sitting there waiting, and she sniffs the perfume that
right.
she had borrowed from a neighbor earlier in the day. And you could see her just thinking back through the events of that day. And you're right. She's still optimistic. But isn't that the nature of someone who's about to get married? I mean, it would take a lot. What's going on through her head, you sense, is, man, these folks are really a mess. I'm so glad I'm not them. I'm so glad I'm not going to be like them.
Right.
And that's
so she
what
may be naive,
kids
but
think.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that the film allows for that, because
exactly.
I think that's just as true as the pain that the older couple is suffering from. So I agree that the movie is rich in the way that it allows for all of these things to be taking place at once. And there's some comfort in that, I guess. The trueness of its observations offers some comfort, that you can say, hey, yeah, I know people who have been there, or I've been there, or I've felt that, or someone else has felt that. Whether it's fears, frustrations, insecurities, all these things the movie makes room for, gets them all right. And that's really impressive.
Yeah, it is. And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about A Separation. We've mentioned it a couple times. Of course, it was a very big film from this past year. It was on my top 10 films of the year. Many critics had it on their top 10 lists. And it was, of course, the winner of the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar. If you haven't seen A Separation, I believe it's out now on demand. You could probably get it via DVD as well. But just a superficial point, if I may, while we're looking at these films, we're almost done with our marathon, only one film left. I find it really interesting that in looking at the films we've seen from the directors we've seen, it's fascinating to see more films by these filmmakers and see how they are unique in terms of their style and their preoccupations. And without trying to reduce these filmmakers in any way, if we had played a match game where I had no idea who directed the films in our lineup,
yeah.
but you had to assign the director to them, just based on seeing A Taste of Cherry, I would have known that Close Up was Kiarostami's movie. And just based on seeing This Is Not a Film, a movie we talked about earlier this year, I would have known that Jafar Panahi made The Mirror, my favorite film so far from this marathon. And then watching Fireworks Wednesday, if you've seen A Separation, it's very clear that they're made by the same filmmaker. Domestic dysfunction, children being put in precarious positions by their parents. The cleaning lady, as we mentioned, plays a major role in both films, being asked to do things she didn't sign up for. And I think that Farhadi, in these two films, he puts these really diverse characters covering different social strata into this pot and then just turns up the heat and watches them boil. And it's often very uncomfortable, but is also often very illuminating.
What's interesting about the match playing game, and you're exactly right about that, but I think that speaks to the richness that we've been able to see.
Right.
Despite that there are common themes and concerns and even techniques in a lot of ways, especially the meta stuff we've seen, these are still very distinctive directors.
They are.
Doing their own style of films. That's been really great to experience.
It has, and I think that even though, as you said, this movie isn't in any way meta like Close Up or A Moment of Innocence or The Mirror, the fact is, maybe this is just where my head's at, the notion of what's real and what isn't, which has dominated this marathon largely, is something that comes into play in this film. The more you learn about these characters, just when you think you've got a character pegged a certain way and you know which side you're on, by the end, you're not sure even what the sides are, much less who you're most sympathetic towards. They all make mistakes. They all put themselves and others in positions that are ethically questionable or just short-sighted and kind of mean. And Mojda, who is the wife, played by a great Iranian actress, Hedja Tehrani, she is someone who is very much losing her sanity because there seems to be all this evidence there pointing to her husband. But then that can all be thrown into question just as easily as she sees it. And all of a sudden, she's back to where she started. And we, as audience members, are kind of back to where we started with all these characters.
Not knowing who to sympathize with is also a hallmark of a separation,
right,
which adds to its richness. And the same thing does happen here. There's no hero. There's no rooting interest, really, which is fine. But it's a decidedly non-Western style of storytelling. Hollywood doesn't do this. And so it's a little jarring at first where you're kind of, if you're more used to Western films and Hollywood drama, you're trying to find that person, right? You're trying to find
exactly.
that center. And it's really rewarding to suddenly realize that's not how this is going to work. And look at all the different things we can observe and take from a story if we're not getting that one perspective of one person.
Absolutely. And I do want to mention one other actress, the cleaning lady, the other main character in this story, the younger, soon-to-be-married hopeful, Tarana Aladusti, as you said, Ruhi is her character's name. She's really wonderful, and as I understand it, she's the lead, Ellie, in another Farhadi film about Ellie, which has gotten great acclaim. It's a movie we wanted to include in this marathon, but really can't get our hands on it. It's not available via Netflix. I don't think even Facets had it. So it's a film we had to overlook, but she's a really interesting actress. Both of the lead women here are very talented, very expressive, and can do a lot with very little. And that certainly makes me more excited to see About Ellie someday.
About Ellie sounds fascinating. It's also a domestic story, from what I understand, but involves a disappearance of a character.
Hmm.
So a little bit more intrigue
yeah.
than what A Separation and this film have, where they seem rooted kind of in one household and the goings-on there. So
right.
I'd love to be able to track that down.
Well, we do only have one film left in this contemporary Iranian marathon. It is Offside from Jafar Panahi. It was a listener's choice. We made that sixth film available for a vote on filmspotting.net, picked five or six options to choose from, and Offside was the most popular pick. It's available via Netflix if you are a Netflix subscriber. We're going to watch it in 2 or 3 weeks, so you have a little bit of time to watch it before we get to our discussion. Of course, if you want to go back and hear reviews or see our ratings for these past films, go to filmspotting.net and click on marathons.
All right, let's see. Timothy Dalton, Pierce Brosnan, Roger Moore, Daniel Craig, and Sean Connery. Looks like Lazenby might be the odd man out on my list of the best cinema spies.
I thought he was in the Pantheon.
Oh, I see.
Lazenby in the Pantheon?
Good. Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Memories light the corners of my mind. Misty watercolor
It month's donation and thank you time here on Film Spotting, as always, brought to you by the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. Jeff just did a massive 2-hour podcast of Django Unchained from 2012's Comic-Con, and according to him, Josh, it's practically spoiler-free, 98% spoiler-free.
Watch out for that 2%.
There you go. He's got interviews with Tarantino, Jamie Foxx, Kerry Washington, Christoph Waltz, Don Johnson, and Walter Goggins. He also released a Bourne Legacy interview featuring the co-writer Dan Gilroy and co-writer-director Tony Gilroy. He even has out a Hope Springs interview with screenwriter Vanessa Taylor. That's a movie with Streep and Tommy Lee Jones, and from what I understand, it's getting fairly decent reviews.
Yeah,
I want
that's
to catch
what
up
I've
with
seen.
That.
Yeah, I didn't expect that, and people have been talking about it in a good way. Jeff's also got his new iPad magazine, Backstory. He just released issue 02, which includes a sequel script. This is interesting, to the film Sideways. It's by Sideways novelist Rex Pickett, and it's based on his award-winning book, Vertical. You can read the entire table of contents for both issues of Backstory. Also, you can find out about updates to the computer version that he's putting together. That's all at backstory.net.
And with that, let's get to our thank yous. We start with a platinum level donor, very generous donation that came from Scott. And as you'll hear, he's in Western Kansas. I hope he doesn't mind us sharing this letter on air. Everything's fair game if you send it to us. And
even if it's handwritten?
Even if
like
it's
his?
Handwritten, yes. And some people do choose to donate instead by sending us a check for whatever reason. They don't want to use PayPal. That's fine. We do have a P.O. box and an address on our website, filmspotting.net. Scott sent us this note.
As a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, I was going to give you my top 5 weather films. I also wanted to express how much your podcast means to me. I rarely have the opportunity to see the films you discuss. Western Kansas is not a hotbed for world cinema, so your insights help to connect me with that larger world. I planned to write these things, then the tragedy in Aurora occurred. If I were an insightful man, I might discuss our violent society and our violent art. If I were an observant man, I might decry our lack of safe places, though great films are rarely safe. They challenge our notions of home, world, and self, just as art always does. If I were an eloquent man, I might write about how film/art can uplift us in times of pain. Alas, I am neither insightful nor observant nor eloquent. What I am is this, old, old and tired.
Yet, Scott writes, I always feel connected to others in a theater. I share with the other members of the audience a communal experience which is so lacking most times in our lives. In a greater sense, the Film Spotting podcast connects a diverse membership of film lovers with one another. Your passionate and intelligent conversations create a community, if only for 60 minutes each week. I thank you for that, Scott Mentzer.
Wow, that's
a
testimony.
I would say that he is insightful and observant and eloquent, and he protests too much because that was a really great letter to receive. Thank you, Scott, for those comments and for your donation. We also have a new $10 a month subscriber to the show, longtime listener Richard Klein in New York, New York.
I've been listening to Film Spotting since way back in the Cinecast days, in those pre-Van Sam Hallgren, hey, let's do a video podcast too era, and every once in a while shoot some money your way. Have you seen the prices they charge for movies nowadays? Why, in my day, we went to Jeffrey or Avalon Theater on the south side of Chicago with $1, and that got us a double feature and popcorn. Get off my lawn, you hippies, and leave me alone. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, after the last couple of podcasts, I thought, damn, just press the F and donate button already. So I've become a $10 a month donor. Was there a section I missed to say why I did this? On the podcast, you are always referring to why people donate, so I thought I might have missed a box. Hence my email.
Well, thank you for sending that email, Richard. It is true that if you sign up for one of the monthly subscriptions, $5 or $10, there's no box to enter comments like there is with the one-time donation. So unfortunately, if you do want to share your top 5 film spotting discoveries or just complain about the kids on your lawn, whatever it may be, prices of movies these days, you have to send us that email as Richard did. Thank you for that. A new Silver Club donor, Brian in Indianapolis, Indiana, and we have 2 new $5 a month donors.
Ryan in Austin, Texas, and Jill in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Also a new Buck a Show donor, $1 for every week, every show of the year, Deborah in Reston, Virginia.
Hi, I'm running the Chicago Marathon in October. I listen to the Film Spotting podcast during my longest run every week. It's become an integral part of my training program.
I say it every time this comes up. Runner's World, where are you?
Yeah.
You should be our biggest sponsor. You should be promoting every episode. You should be paying for every episode of Film Spotting. Lots of runners out there. A lot of people exercising while they listen to Film Spotting.
And if Deborah wins the Chicago Marathon, we get to take credit for that, right?
I think we should at least get a medal or
medal. I'll take a
piece
medal.
Of the medal.
I don't know if they give them medals, but I'll take one.
I'll take one as well. Other donors we want to thank: Kevin in San Diego, California; Jeremy in Burien, Washington; Peter in Washington, D.C. Peter got a mention a few weeks ago on the show. He has a new short story collection out, The Appearance of a Hero, and he complimented me, Josh, on the fact that I got his last name right, whether it was Peter Levine or Peter Levine.
Uh-huh.
I thought, that's great. I got it right. I'll get it right this time, too, except I have no idea what I
you
said
can't
last
remember.
Time.
Wow.
No, I really don't. I just think of Shelley the Machine Levine from Glengarry Glen Ross.
And there you go.
I want to call him Peter Levine, but it's probably Levine. Peter, I apologize. If you want to check out his work, you don't need to know how to say it to spell it, Peter-Levine or Levine.com. We also want to thank Breton in Centerville, Virginia, who's going to close us out with this nice note.
Here's the donation I promised several weeks ago. In return, I'd like to say, one, why wasn't Inspector Clouseau on the list of the top five crackpots?
Well, I would have to have actually seen The Pink Panther.
Oh, really?
No, haven't seen it.
Well, I wouldn't put him on because he doesn't really have a fully formed plan he's trying to achieve. That was kind of one of our criteria.
That's true.
But,
so there you have it.
He's worth consideration. Number two, I'd like to champion what I think is one of the most underrated films of my lifetime, Clint Eastwood's A Perfect World. I showed it every year to my high school film study classes, and every year it was the collective favorite of the class. I've been a listener since April, listened to my first episodes while attending Ebertfest, so I don't know all the top five lists. Here are some possibilities. One, top five movies about school. Two, top five movies everyone likes better than me. Gladiator for me, he says. Number three, top five, I'll always remember the experience of sitting in the theater for these movies. For him, Burton's Batman was it. It was a preview. He says the audience did the wave before it started. Seriously.
Sounds a little bit like a nightmare, actually, doing the wave.
Why are people doing the wave in
a
movie theater?
It was the 80s. Thank you, Breton, for that and those ideas. I don't know if we've done movies about school. We have certainly done movies similar, movies that are about teachers, I know we've done before, and movies everyone likes better than me. We've done our top five overrated films before, but it was a long time ago, like the first couple months of the show, so maybe that's one
that would be a fun one
we could do at some point. The last one about movies that you remember seeing in the theater, I flagged this note for bonus content sometime, maybe it's something we could dive into. I have to be honest, off the top of my head, I can only think of about three or four movies that I really remember sitting in the theater to watch. I don't know that there's a great story behind any of them. Do you have any?
Yeah, I'd have to think of them. They're going to all go back to my childhood.
Right.
So I don't know if that makes the list a little bit limited. They'd also go back to interesting Chicago theaters, I think, that don't exist anymore. Like McClurg Court comes to mind, which is just this huge theater.
Yeah.
Not far from where
I
we are here by
line.
Navy Pier, actually.
There.
Yeah. So that's gone. So that would be an interesting nostalgic list to put together. I don't know if anyone else would care.
I don't know either, but it is an interesting concept, maybe one we'll get to at a later date. Thank you to all of our donors. We appreciate every penny you send us, every hard-earned dollar. It goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing.
Can it be that it was all so simple then? Or has time rewritten every line? If we had a chance to do it all again,
hi, this is Andrew Stanton. I'm the director of films like Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now John Carter, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
Hey, Josh and Adam. This is Danielle in Chicago. I loved your top five of the plays. I was a little sad to hear Noise Was Off left off the list. It's a 1982 English play that was filmed in 1992, starring Michael Caine, Carol Burnett, John Ritter, Christopher Reeve, Nicolette Sheridan, and Mary Lou Henner. It's a farce. It allows you to see what happens behind the scenes of a play gone wrong. And the real humor of the play and the movie comes in these variations each time they redo the same scenes over and over as the offstage drama starts to affect what happens on stage. Without a doubt, the best part of the movie is Act Two, which takes place behind the scenes almost completely in total silence. It's 100% physical comedy. A really delightful movie if you haven't seen it. Thanks, guys.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That was Danielle with an overlooked pick from our top five play adaptations a few weeks ago, the movie Noises Off, a movie I have seen and enjoy, Josh. Actually, we use Noises Off occasionally as one of the clips that you'll hear in Massacre Theater. When you hear the Massacre Theater theme music, we do use Noises Off. Michael Caine has many great lines in that film. So Danielle, with a great pick, but one that just didn't quite make our list of our top five play adaptations.
I've never seen Noises Off, but I'm going to put that behind 12 Angry Men,
right?
Because apparently I'm in big trouble for not ever having seen 12 Angry Men.
Yeah, I don't think we should discuss it any further. We will discuss further, though, our top five play adaptations in this week's bonus content. If you are a Film Spotting app subscriber, you can get it in iTunes or from Amazon's App World for Android. You can also get it other ways if you go to filmspotting.net and click on apps. We have all of the information there. We share a little extra bonus content every week, and we're going to dive into your feedback on our top five play adaptations. Yes, all of you Cat on a Hot Tin Roof detractors out there.
There were a lot of them, weren't there?
There was a lot of support, Josh, and I'm really disappointed. That's also something I don't want to discuss further right now. Let's get to this week's top five. Our cinema spies, of course, tying in with our discussion of the new Bourne film, the new Aaron Cross movie, The Bourne Legacy. And we should note, this is going to be the James Bond memorial list.
Yes.
So none of the Bonds are going to make our picks. We'll just put him away for our purposes here. I will also note that I have a little personal penalty box. Two movies that have come up plenty on the show over the past 7 years that could have fit into this list that I'm going to omit. The Bourne trilogy, Jason Bourne, not going to make my list.
Okay.
And The Manchurian Candidate. Another film often thought of as a spy movie. I think it could work for this list, but it's one, as I mentioned, I've talked about quite a bit.
Shouldn't
over
it be
the
in
years.
The Pantheon then?
It's not quite Pantheon ready.
So
it's just not Pantheon
there's
ready.
There's this middle ground. There's
the penalty boxes for
penalty
those movies
box
that
and the,
they just haven't quite earned that status yet. But
so you get
come
one more mention. Is that how it works? You'll get one more mention at the perfect time. That puts it, I'm just trying to understand the rules here.
There are no rules to the Pantheon.
No, there are so many rules.
They're all unwritten, and we're making them up as we go, Josh. So stop asking me tough questions and explain your top five. Give me your number five pick for Cinema Spy.
Julia Roberts in Duplicity.
Really?
Yes.
Tony Gilroy.
I'm keeping up with the theme here. It's Tony Gilroy's last film, and Roberts and Clive Owen play former government spooks. So she's not a government spy here. Instead, she's now working as a corporate spy. The dialogue in this film, and I know I've talked about it before on Film Spotting, not quite ready for the penalty box, but I have mentioned it before. The dialogue here is almost as quick and witty as His Girl Friday. And you know by now that I don't say such a thing lightly. Roberts especially excels at it. She has the natural, playful screen presence that's perfect for this sort of thing. Roberts is a really interesting actor because I don't think of her much. When she stopped working and slowed down her career, I didn't really miss her. But then she shows up in something like this, and it reminds me of how good she can be in the right movie.
Yeah, I think it's an underrated film. Certainly, I don't know if I love it as much as you do, but I think it's one that probably a lot of people out there listening right now overlooked. And it's certainly worth seeing. There isn't a lot of criteria for these lists. I think we've both talked about that off air, that a lot of times we're making some restrictions and we're coming up with ways to pare down our lists. Here, a spy is a spy. If you're caught up in espionage, but not an assassin, that's a whole separate top five
right.
that I think we've done, then that works for this list. Or if you do actual spying as part of your job, if surveillance is what you primarily do, I think obviously that counts as being a spy. And after your Duplicity pick, people out there hoping for some bigger guns to come out on this list, some more well-known titles, are going to be very disappointed by my number five. But I'm sorry, the first two names that came up for me when this topic was decided on were Austin Milbarge and Emmett Fitzhugh from the John Landis film Spies Like Us. This is a movie, Josh, with a 35% Rotten Tomatoes rating.
Oh,
that's rotten. But you know what? All those critics are wrong. Or maybe they're not wrong, and I'll just have to defend this movie as a nostalgia pick. It's a movie I saw in the theater when I was 10 years old, probably watched it 100 times on VHS and HBO after that. Of course, Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd play the lead characters. They take the Foreign Service exam. They fail miserably, but end up getting selected anyway, unbeknownst to them, to be decoys for the real American spies overseas. I looked at the quotes from this film today. I watched some scenes on YouTube. I can't help it. It still makes me laugh.
All right. Stop right there, and I'll bring back the sun. Okay? This is my sister. You can all have her. I hear she's very good.
Chevy Chase, of course, in his prime, but also Dan Aykroyd is really someone you have to appreciate. I actually just watched Ghostbusters again the other night with my kids. I just watched it with my oldest, Holden. The other kids wanted to see Ghostbusters, and Holden was game because he really enjoyed it. And I spent a good amount of time this time watching Ghostbusters, probably for me the 100th or 150th, watching Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray gets so much credit, and rightfully so. And Harold Ramis is great, too, of course. But Aykroyd's really funny and a great subtle yin to Bill Murray's grandiose yang. And yes, Murray's grandiose yang is the name of my next band, by the way. But he's great in Ghostbusters, and he's really good in Spies Like Us. And of course, a little bit of movie trivia. You can look for Sam Raimi and Joel Coen in brief cameos as security guards at a drive-in.
Did not know that. Dan Aykroyd has some good lines in the campaign, actually.
Oh, does he?
Bit part, yeah.
I haven't seen that yet.
I have fond, vague memories of Spies Like Us. Not strong enough to be able to put on this list, so I'm glad you put it there so you can take the
I can get the hate mail.
There you go. My number four, well, I don't know if I'm allowed to pick this now with all of your rules and regulations, but I went with Angela Lansbury in The Manchurian Candidate.
It's just my penalty box, Josh. You
okay.
haven't picked it yet.
Good, good.
It's fair game.
Now, I'm a little worried, though. Does this count as a spoiler by naming Angela Lansbury as a spy in Manchurian Candidate?
It came out in, what, 62?
Hopefully enough people have seen it. We do learn that Lansbury, who's the wife of a senator, is actually a communist agent. It's her son, played by Lawrence Harvey, who was brainwashed while a POW in the Korean War. And when he returns, she's in charge of triggering him to attempt a political assassination. Lansbury is venomous, though, even before we learn this about her. She's this domineering and politically ambitious mother who manipulates both her husband and her son. It's a devilish performance.
It's been decided that you will be dressed as a priest to help you get away in the pandemonium afterwards. Chun-Jin will give you a two-piece Soviet Army sniper's rifle that fits nicely into a special bag. There's a spotlight booth that won't be in use. It's up under the roof on the 8th Avenue side of the garden. It will have absolutely clear, protected shooting.
Now, I'm someone who knew Lansbury first as a kid when my mom would watch Murder, She Wrote, as a lot of people did. So this was quite a revelation
yeah.
when I finally got around to see Manchurian Candidate. And then on our last top five list, I mentioned 1944's Gaslight, which was her first movie role, actually. She plays a flirty British maid of all things in that movie, and is good as well. So she's full of surprises, that Angela Lansbury.
She is a very, very talented actress. I'll stick with the communism theme for my number four cinema spy. It's Jack Ryan from The Hunt for Red October. Also a nostalgia pick, but one I would certainly hold up and say probably works today. I think it's a really good thriller. Directed by John McTiernan. And you have to give him some credit. He's made some bad films since, but he has a pretty good three-year span here from 1987 to 1990. He makes Predator, he makes Die Hard, and he makes The Hunt for Red October. All three, for me, good films. Yes, even Predator is
I was going to say, what's the best film of
those
three?
Very enjoyable action movie.
Predator, please tell me you say Predator.
Predator would not be number one
okay.
of those three, but yes, it is a movie I like. Ryan, I think, is notable as a character, whether it's Alec Baldwin or later Harrison Ford playing him in Patriot Games, because he's a guy who seems better suited to be behind a desk. He's someone who clearly uses his brains more than his brawn. You think of Patriot Games, it's a case where he gets caught up in something. He gets involved in something inadvertently. And in Hunt for October, Alec Baldwin is thrown into the field because he's got this crazy intellectual idea he's come up with about what he thinks Sean Connery's Captain Ramius is up to, that he's actually trying to defect with this nuclear submarine. Alec Baldwin, too, is a guy now we think of as this great character actor, but he certainly was a very good leading man, I think, in The Hunt for Red October, and surrounded by great people. I was looking at the cast. Obviously, I remember Sean Connery and a few other big names, but not only do you have Connery and Alec Baldwin, you've got Scott Glenn, Sam Neill, James Earl Jones, Joss Ackland, Richard Jordan, Tim Curry, Stellan Skarsgård, Courtney B. Vance, Jeffrey Jones of Ferris Bueller's Principal fame, and Fred Thompson also makes an appearance there. All these great that guys and other very good character actors in The Hunt for October that just elevate it above your kind of simple Cold War spy fare. I think it's a really good action film.
Who's Tim Curry? That's the one that jumped out at me.
Yeah, he's one of the Russian characters.
Okay.
He's on board the sub.
Yeah,
I can't remember
I can picture it.
His
All
exact
right.
role, but The Hunt for Red October and Jack Ryan's my number four.
Good film. Number three for me, Cary Grant in Notorious. Alfred Hitchcock's 1946 thriller is one of those rare spy films where the romance isn't just a side note. It drives the drama, and more importantly, you actually believe in it. Ingrid Bergman plays the daughter of a German-American traitor, and when he's sentenced for spying, American agent Cary Grant recruits her to infiltrate her father's former friends. They fall for each other, though neither one will fully admit it, and this makes things very complicated when one of her father's friends, played by Claude Rains, asks her to marry him.
there's not a lot of trust between these two to begin with, given their respective histories, and what's there is sorely tested by this assignment. What I like about Grant's performance is that he has a bitterness here that we usually don't associate with him. It does work perfectly for this role, though. He's jealous and protective, but he can't show that for both professional and personal reasons. And this eats at him throughout the movie. I'd put it up there with Grant's best performances.
Maybe so. He's certainly great in that Alfred Hitchcock film. And for my number three, I've got the peanut butter to your chocolate. I also went with Notorious, but instead of Devlin, I went with Ingrid Bergman as Alicia, the love interest, the one who actually, Josh, let's give her some credit, the one who actually goes undercover and puts herself at risk while Devlin sits on the beach or something and waits for her report. So I think that alone elevates her maybe a little bit above Devlin for my list. I think what comes out in this film, and you hinted at it a little bit, is this is a key issue for the spy we see in other spy movies. This notion of putting the country above all else, sacrificing your personal life for a higher calling, choosing duty over love. And there's that great line in the film where she says at one point to Devlin, you can add Sebastian's name to my list of playmates, playing off his feelings for her, his feelings of jealousy, his notions of her wild past, and the fact that she's willing to kind of cut him a little bit to hurt him because he's put her in this situation. And when Claude Rains proposes to her, she tells him, and it's clear that she's hoping he's going to finally expose his feelings for her. They're finally going to come out into the open, and he doesn't do it. He plays it straight. He plays the spy, choosing duty over love. And there's just something for me beautifully tragic about Alicia committing herself to this cause and going as far as she does, maybe on some level to prove that she can and to prove that she's risen above the person she was before. But really, it's not for her country. It's for him. That's how she proves her love for Devlin, even though it hurts him, is she does what he needs her to do in order for the mission to be a success. And so there's this great double-edged sword you see play out throughout the film that makes it such a great romance in addition to being a great espionage thriller.
I respect your pick. I understand it. But here's my defense for going with Grant. You mentioned even the title, Notorious, refers to Bergman's risque past. And I just feel throughout the movie she doesn't quite have that carnality to her that would suggest that. There's something a little
Ingrid Bergman doesn't?
No. There's something removed to her in this film that doesn't quite capture that aspect of the character. Not saying it's a bad performance, but that's just why I went with Grant.
Emil Hupke, heard of him?
No.
He made quite a scene about a wine bottle the other night.
Isn't that vintage?
Seemed to think of something else in the bottle.
Wasn't there?
No. It was wine, we drank it.
Has he pulled anything since?
Haven't seen him since.
Anything else?
Nothing important. Just a minor item, but you may want it for the record.
What is it?
You can add Sebastian's name to my list of playmates.
Pretty fast work.
That's what you wanted, wasn't it?
Skip it.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five cinema spies in connection with our discussion of The Bourne Legacy. Josh, you're number two.
Sam Rockwell in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. You should never be able to pin a good spy down, and you certainly can't pin down Sam Rockwell in this adaptation of the highly suspect autobiography of Gong Show host Chuck Barris. Barris, of course, claimed to have been an assassin for the CIA. Is he telling the truth? Just talking big? Is he out of his mind? You're never quite sure, and Rockwell channels that dizzying instability. I think I picked him, actually, the first show I was ever on. We did Top 5 Gonzo Characters, and I picked him there for similar reasons. I don't think Rockwell's ever going to break through to the level of notoriety that he deserves. That window has probably closed, even though he continues to do good work. Yet, after the likes of Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, even the film spotting favorite Moon, I sit up and take notice whenever he shows up on screen. You realize he was even instrumental in making Charlie's Angels a good picture.
Actually, he is very watchable in the first Charlie's Angels film.
Yeah.
He's the only redeeming aspect of that
good
movie,
stuff.
Unfortunately. That's a good pick. I like that movie, though I like Sam Rockwell's performance as Chuck Barris better than I like the film as a whole. My number two is a classic espionage thriller and another case like The Hunt for Red October and Jack Ryan of a bookish analyst, a researcher thrust into the action, and that's Joe Turner from 3 Days of the Condor, the 1975 Sidney Pollack thriller. Unlike Jack Ryan, this is a case where Joe Turner really has no military background whatsoever. He really is getting caught up in something way beyond him, a lot like Hitchcock's North by Northwest in some ways, though I didn't really consider that for this list because it's just a case of mistaken identity. I'm sure we'll get some emails saying it should be considered. But Redford is just good in these roles. I liked him as well in the Tony Scott movie Spy Game. I think kind of an underrated movie where he plays a mentor as a spy to Brad Pitt's character. And it helps in 3 Days of the Condor that he ends up working with one of my favorite actresses, Faye Dunaway. He at first kidnaps her basically to help him, forces her to help him, but then they do develop a bond. So I love the chemistry between those two characters there. I love the 70s paranoia note that runs throughout this film, but especially the way 3 Days of the Condor ends. There's a lot of ambiguity and unease, even with what could potentially be seen as a happy ending. But I think on the whole, just having this character thrust into something that he really has no business being a part of, and we get to then kind of live through him and experience it as if it were us caught up in this scheme, that's something that I think is really effective in 3 Days of the Condor.
My name is Turner. I work for you. Now listen.
Identify yourself.
What
is your designation?
Condor. Section 9, Department 17. The section's been hit.
What level?
What level?
Level of damage.
Everybody. Dr. Lapp, Janice, Ray, Harold. Harold was in the,
Are you in a company line?
No, I'm in a phone booth. I'm just a block away. I'm in the street.
You're in violation of secure communication procedures, Condor.
Listen, you son of a bitch. I'm telling you, I came back with lunch and it was raining and the whole house was murdered. Everybody is dead.
That brings us to my number one cinema spy, which would be Richard Burton in The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. I did think about Gary Oldman from last year's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but really he's an heir to Richard Burton in this other John le Carré adaptation. Burton plays Alec Lemus, a British agent who's pulled out of Germany and given a desk job in the midst of the Cold War so that he can be dangled before the East Germans as a potential double agent. Now, Oldman in Tinker Tailor captures a certain world weariness with all of this work. Burton here isn't just weary. He's exhausted by all the espionage and betrayal that he's built his life upon. Paranoid, bedraggled, burrowed in a dingy raincoat, he drains the spy genre of any ounce of glamour. That's what I found fascinating about the performance and the film, especially when you consider that this was just as James Bond was getting started. This is 1965, Dr. No, 1962.
Wow. Well, you've got me more intrigued to see that movie. It's one I've always regretted not being able to catch up with. So you got me with your number one there, Josh. My number one, I'm guessing, is a cinema spy you are familiar with. And I mentioned John McTiernan and his brilliant cinematic run from 87 to 90, starting with Predator, of course, a masterpiece. I'm not sure McTiernan's run quite matches the run of this director from 1972 to 1974, The Godfather, The Godfather Part II, and this film, The Conversation. The director is Francis Ford Coppola. The star of The Conversation is Gene Hackman as Harry Call. He lives in San Francisco. He is a surveillance expert. He gets hired by people, essentially kind of like a private detective, to keep an eye on them, to tape them, to bug them, and then to report back. And he's caught up in this case that we see from the start of the film, and we see play out throughout the entire film in various incarnations. Cindy Williams, Frederick Forrest are the actors. They're clearly embroiled in some relationship and some kind of larger plot that Harry Call is trying to wrap his head around. And he's got something tangible. He's got the audio that should prove something, that should be conclusive of something he can wrap his head around. But as we see throughout the film, he keeps coming back to it, trying to get some more bit of truth out of it. It makes me, of course, think of Antonioni and Blow Up and the photographs, and then Blowout later from De Palma. It's sound again playing a key role, but he's just diving in deeper, trying to uncover something deeper, decipher some truth beyond the surface of that audio. And that conversation is the key to this entire film, The Conversation. And that line, he'll kill us if he had the chance. I think part of the thrill of this film for me is just watching Gene Hackman be really good at his job. He keeps refining and refining the audio, learning a little bit more every time when he factors in other things he's learning.
Do you think we can do this?
Tired of drinking anyhow.
What a stupid conversation.
Stan, please, I'm trying to work.
Tired of mostly everything.
Tired of me.
Tired of you. But not today.
What the hell are they talking about, for Christ's sake?
Stanley, please, I'm trying to get this done.
All right, don't get excited, man.
Well, I'm getting fed up. How about you're asking me questions all day long?
Jesus.
Don't say that.
For Christ's sake,
Stan, don't say that again, please. Don't use that word in vain. It bothers me.
What's the matter, Harry?
Your work's getting sloppy.
That scene stood out for me for a lot of reasons as emblematic of why I love this film and that character. Not only do you have the great character actor John Cazale in that scene as an assistant that works with him, but it reveals so much about Harry Call, his sense of morality, his Catholicism, this notion that it's a stupid conversation is something Cazale says at the start of it, even though it has potentially life and death consequences. That seems to really ruffle Gene Hackman's feathers. And his professionalism, as I mentioned, the conflict of trying to practice what he preaches, actually being detached, just doing your job, not caring about the outcome or the results, just doing what you're told to do. This brings us back to the Bourne legacy. He's been given a certain job. Just give him the audio, give him his report, and move on. He can't do that. He ends up compromising himself, and we see where that leads him with the great end shot, one of the all-time great movie end shots to the conversation. So Harry Call's my number one.
Much more respectable than Spies Like Us. I'm glad you came around.
I tried to make up for my Spies Like Us pick. I'm glad that worked for you, Josh. What about any honorable mentions?
I did think about Matt Damon as Jason Bourne. Also, Val Kilmer came up a lot on Twitter when I put this out there, and I did consider more in Top Secret probably than Spartan, the David Mamet film, but he's good in both of those. Tom Cruise in Night and Day, which is actually a better character and film in a lot of ways than Mission Impossible.
No, it's not.
I know your
not
love,
even Mission Impossible
I know your
two.
Love for the latest Mission Impossible, so I'm really risking your anger here.
Yes, you are.
Lastly, John Malkovich in Burn After Reading, I thought might have made this list.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting pick, one I didn't consider. You mentioned George Smiley, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, played by Gary Oldman. That's really my number six pick. That was one I considered. Even though I didn't love that film, I respect it and admire it more than love it. I love that character for the reasons you mentioned with your number one, the deglamorization of the spy, the restraint, the fact that every time he has a conversation with someone, he's just waiting for you to slip up and reveal too much information because he reveals nothing. I love that spy character, George Smiley. I, of course, have to give Michael Fassbender some love. Archie Hickox, the film critic turned spy in Inglourious Basterds, the Tarantino film. I also consider the Scott character played by Val Kilmer in Spartan. Not a great film. I don't love that Mamet film, but I like that character a lot. And Derek Flint, our man Flint. Up until the last minute today, he was in my top five.
Oh, he
just
got booted out.
Ugh. Got booted out by Spies Like Us. I had to do it. But that's a film that is really good, campy fun. And before Austin Powers, you had Derek Flint and the parody of those Bond films from the 60s. So definitely worth an honorable mention there. Those are our top five cinema spies. Send us your picks or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. Or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and @Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out wide this weekend, speaking of Predator and other great action films, you have Expendables 2.
Oh, yeah.
The Odd Life of Timothy Green. I still haven't seen Expendables 1, Josh. Were you a fan of that
movie? How is that possible?
Because I actually don't care about those films anymore. I did when I was a kid, but now I don't.
I haven't seen it either. So.
Okay. The Odd Life of Timothy Green is out. Sparkle. This is the 2012 version of Sparkle. Whitney Houston somehow in that movie. I don't know. Actually, do you know what the hell's with this film? Why am I?
I think you should keep going. I think you should keep going.
I meant to look it up.
I think you just say Sparkle and proceed.
Okay.
That's all anyone in Film Spotting Nation needs to know.
Sparkle, out in wide release, and Paranorman, a new animated film that I'm kind of curious about.
Yeah, it looks good. It's from the studio, I believe, that did Coraline, which I love. Not the same director, though, not Henry Selick.
Well, hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up with that at some point. In limited release, 2 days in New York, the Julie Delpy movie, and 360, I believe this is the latest film from Fernando Morales, who made City of God and also Blindness. Next week on the show, Michael Phillips will be here from the Tribune, and we are diving into the sight and sound waters, whether we're ready or not,
whether we can
sink or swim. We're going to try to come up with our 10 greatest films of all time.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist this week was the late Marvin Hamlisch. You can learn more about his life and his music at marvinhamlisch.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.